Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday, the 19th of January. Today, the government is expected to announce its second bailout of the banks. £200 billion worth of toxic debt will be insured by the taxpayer. The Lib Dems' Vince Cable gives his reaction.
When you're in the middle of the Blitz, why are you worrying about post-war reconstruction?
Also today, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. We hear from The Guardian's reporter in Gaza. And we hear from Tokyo's colourful red light district, which is being threatened by the city's bid to host the Olympics.
In more relaxed times, Tezuka's Club, where young men are paid to chat to female customers, pour their drinks, and yes, flirt a bit, would have stayed open until dawn.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and the papers.
The Chancellor will today stake hundreds of billions of pounds of taxpayers' money on a second bank bailout. It's in a bid to free up blocked credit markets and head off a worsening recession. It's understood Alistair Darling will set out plans for the government to underwrite the so-called toxic assets held by banks in an effort to restore shaken confidence in the sector. Should also release more funds for lending. The Treasury has been looking at the proposals for several weeks after it became clear October's £37 billion bailout had failed to provide a sufficient platform for normal lending to resume. We'll get the reaction of the Lib Dems Treasury spokesman in just a moment. Former Chancellor Kenneth Clark will today make a dramatic return to the Tory front bench as David Cameron reshuffles his shadow cabinet. Senior party sources say Mr. Clark, one of the acknowledged big beasts of the Conservative Party, will be appointed Shadow Business and Enterprise Secretary. He'll replace Alan Duncan, who'll be offered another post in the reshuffle. Mr. Clark's appointment will pitch him directly against Lord Mandelson, whose reappointment to the Labour front bench last year represented a similarly audacious gamble by Gordon Brown. Israeli forces are pulling out of the Gaza Strip following a tentative truce with Hamas. It's ended 3 weeks of heavy fighting. Arab and European leaders are now scrambling to agree lasting arrangements to prevent a new outbreak of hostilities. Later in this programme, we'll be hearing from inside Gaza, as well as from our Middle East editor, on whether the ceasefire will hold. It's the final day for the George W. Bush presidency. Tomorrow, Barack Obama will take over at the White House. Yesterday, the president-elect attended a concert featuring Bruce Springsteen and Beyoncé. Taking the rostrum to address the crowd, Obama again warned America it faces a huge battle to stop the economy from sliding into another Great Depression. New figures obtained by UK children's charity Show Police are recording more than 50 sexual offences against youngsters every day. The NSPCC says there were nearly 21,000 alleged sex crimes involving under-18s reported to officers in England and Wales in 2008. Almost one in four cases, the victims were 10 or younger, and more than 800 offences involving children aged 4 and 10. The data gathered from Freedom of Information requests also shows six times more sex crimes were recorded against girls than boys. Look at this morning's papers now. The Telegraph's take on the latest banking bailout is that taxpayers could take shares in Barclays and HSBC for the first time. It's being called Cameron's gamble in The Independent as Ken Clark makes a controversial return to the centre stage of British politics. The paper also reports how the appointment's already creating concern within the party. The Sun claims a plague similar to the Black Death has wiped out at least 40 Al-Qaeda terrorists at a training camp. There's new hope for a cure for blindness in the Express, as well as a warning Britain's about to get treacherous wintry weather from America this week. Snow, sleet and hail will lash the UK, with temperatures returning to sub-zero levels. The Mirror shows Boy George signing autographs for fellow prisoners in his tiny jail cell. And The Mail speaks to Leonardo DiCaprio about his new film with Kate Winslet, Revolutionary Road. He says kissing her on a film set is like kissing a family member. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
It's being called the mother of all bank insurance schemes. In a second package of measures designed to boost lending, the government is expected to guarantee £200 billion worth of so-called toxic debt. The government officials have been talking to bank chiefs over the weekend after steep falls in bank shares last week. On Friday, Barclays lost almost a quarter of its value in a single hour. The Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesman, Vincent Cable, gives his reaction.
There seem to be a variety of things. First of all, it would appear that the government is either preparing either to buy up or to insure past bad debts by the bank, the so-called toxic debts. I have to say, I think that's a thoroughly bad idea. The taxpayer is already up to its neck in the banks already without taking on vast new liabilities. Moreover, it's not at all clear to me that this is a priority. Somebody rather helpfully drew the analogy, when you're in the middle of the Blitz, why are you worrying about post-war reconstruction? I mean, this is a longer-term, second-order problem, and there's no point the government getting into it now, particularly as it's very, very difficult to value these bad assets. And that's not where the priority is. The priority is to get the banks in lending mode to good British companies.
There's also proposals apparently to transfer the government's preference shares in the Royal Bank of Scotland into ordinary shares. So that'll be, in effect, a full nationalisation. Why is the Royal Bank of Scotland in so much trouble?
Well, it's engaged in some extremely foolish, reckless behaviour in the past. There have been a whole lot of problems associated with the acquisition of the big Dutch bank, which is now apparently, one of the newspapers this morning described how it lent £2 billion to a Russian oligarch who seems to have lost it. So Fred Goodwin and his generation of senior bankers made some appallingly bad decisions. And these are now coming home to roost. What the Royal Bank of Scotland has in common with some of the others, notably Barclays, is that their investment banking operations, which were effectively operated like casinos, have just lost vast sums of money. And that's why these banks are in terrible difficulties. It's currently the Royal Bank of Scotland which is most exposed. But what's emerged in the stock market over the last few days is that the market's realised that Barclays isn't in a much better position than they be in the same state. Now, as far as the remedy is concerned, the government already owns 60% of the shares. Extending that to 70% doesn't in itself change very much. What is necessary is that that bank, because it is so big and because it's so important to the UK economy, will have to be directed to give priority to new lending.
You mentioned the problem of lending. There are also reports that Northern Rock may be handed further billions. The amount varies according from report to report. But it would be used as a good bank, in inverted commas, to boost lending. I mean, how would that work? Do you think that might be something that would get things going again?
Well, it seems an improvement on where we are at the moment. I mean, although it made sense a year ago to say to Northern Rock that the main purpose of its existence was to run off its assets and get the money back for the taxpayer as quickly as possible, it's clear that that whole strategy has been overtaken by events, and Northern Rock has to be able to contribute to new lending flows to sound borrowers. And I guess this is a recognition that there is now a fundamental change in direction.
The fact that the government's considering a second bailout of the banks, in effect, does that mean that the first bailout, the one that we saw in October when £37 billion of taxpayers' money was used to recapitalise the banks, does that mean that October's investment by the taxpayer hasn't worked?
Well, it certainly hasn't produced the results that were expected, and that's why I'm very reluctant to support any additional commitment, particularly in areas like the buying up or guaranteeing of toxic debt. I mean, I think there is a major set of questions here. I mean, I don't know, and I don't know whether you know, but where this £37 billion actually went. The basic understanding at the time was that it would be used to maintain lending flows to business and to other sound borrowers, and that doesn't seem to have happened. I've never seen the figures. They've never been published, but as far as I can see, the money has simply been used to prop up the balance sheets of the banks, which was not the original objective. So we should, under no circumstances, just be pumping in more money until that £37 billion has been put to good use, maintaining loans. I mean, what we mean here is, I mean, there are a lot of very good British companies that are not insolvent, that are perfectly competent, and are not able to pay their wages at the moment because they can't get their revolving credit, can't get their working capital. And that's what the banks are there for. And the overriding priority for the use of that £37 billion should be to get this lending flows going.
Vince Cable. Our chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, was travelling with the Prime Minister in the Middle East yesterday. I asked him what Gordon Brown said about the banking crisis.
Today is going to be a very significant day for the government as it tries to really saved the economy from collapse. We, of course, had the recapitalization program for the banks back in the autumn. That was a great success on one level because, hey, it prevented the banks from collapsing, but not a success on another level because the banks, of course, are not lending. And ministers are really, really worried that if banks aren't lending, then that could have grave consequences for the economy. So this morning, we're going to have an early morning announcement, an early morning statement of the government plan to the markets. And then about 9 o'clock, we'll have a joint press conference with Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling. And then Alistair Darling will make a statement to the House of Commons. What government sources are saying is that the whole point about what they're going to be announcing today is to really get lending moving again, oil the wheels. And one of the key elements is going to be an insurance scheme. This is going to be an insurance scheme based on a model that's being used at UBS, Citigroup and Bank of America. They don't want to go down the route of a so-called bad bank, the bad bank that takes all the toxic assets. They don't think that will work, not least because that will involve a lot of upfront taxpayers' money, which inevitably would go to foreign banks because around a third of the UK banking market is, of course, foreign banks. So what you do is you have an insurance scheme. The government would charge a fee for insuring these banks. It would need less actual upfront money. And in their fantasy world, ministers hope that it would restore confidence, therefore restore lending, and actually not be a huge drain on the public purse, because it would be about getting back confidence. That's the key thing that we haven't got at the moment.
Now, Nick, you've been with Gordon Brown as he attends an international summit in Egypt on the crisis in Gaza before flying to Israel for a meeting with Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister. What's Gordon Brown been saying about Gaza?
Essentially, at the heart of that conference, it was saying two things. One, we really need to get humanitarian assistance into Gaza. Gordon Brown was talking about how 100,000 people have been displaced. When we see the full horror of what's going on in Gaza, it is going to need humanitarian assistance very, very quickly. And the second element, well, Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, no longer holds the presidency of the European Union, but hey, he's behaving as if he still does, because he was the co-chair of the conference with Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt. And Nicolas Sarkozy is saying, we've got two ceasefires on the table. We have an Israeli ceasefire. We have a Hamas ceasefire. This is a great opportunity that we should seize. And he was talking about convening another great Middle East peace conference modeled on the famous one that was held in Madrid in 1991 after the first Gulf War. Now, that, of course, led to what did seem at the time in the 1990s as a great step forward towards a two-state solution, an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. But, of course, that didn't work. But essentially, we know what the contours of a deal are. They have to be two states, a viable Palestinian state based mostly on the territories occupied by Israel since 1967. Sarkozy is saying we have a great opportunity to push ahead with that.
Nick Watt. Well, Israel's unilateral ceasefire began early on Sunday. Its air and ground offensive has claimed more than 1,300 Palestinian lives since the 27th of December. 12 hours after Israel's ceasefire began, Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups in Gaza announced their own ceasefire. They said in a statement they'd give Israeli troops a week to leave. The Guardian's Middle East correspondent, Rory McCarthy, is in Gaza. He describes the scene after 22 days of bombardment.
It's late at night now. I'm in Rafah, which is the southernmost town in the Gaza Strip. I'm in the house of a Palestinian friend, and we're about 500 metres from the Egyptian border. So this is an area that was heavily shelled over the last 3 weeks. In particular, Israeli fighter jets were targeting the tunnel network under the border between Gaza and Egypt, which they say was used for smuggling in weapons. Because the shelling was so close, it's caused tremendous problems for the people here. They've talked about being unable to sleep at night because of the bombing, having to take the glass out of their windows to make sure it doesn't shatter. So it's been freezing cold at night. They've had shortages of electricity and particularly of water. That's a real problem. In order to get drinking water, they've had to go out of the house to a nearby desalination station and carry back containers of water simply in order to drink.
What's the mood like among the people in Gaza that you've met so far?
Well, people are completely exhausted and pretty shell-shocked at what's happened. Several of the buildings nearby have been destroyed, police stations, mosques that had some sort of connection with Hamas, ordinary houses. When you walk around the streets, there are shops open now and people are out on the street. That will be the first time that they're out in the evening. It's only since the ceasefire has begun. And I think people are still very shell-shocked.
What's their assessment of the ceasefires that were declared on Sunday by both Israel and Hamas?
I'm quite surprised, but they're very pessimistic about this. They understand exactly what's happened, that both Israel declared a ceasefire first, followed a few hours later by Hamas, but they don't believe that this is the end to the fighting. Rafah in particular is an area that has seen heavy fighting over many, many years, and they are very worried that within a few days' time, it could return to the kind of clashes and fighting and bombing that they've endured over the last 3 weeks.
Rory McCarthy in Rafah. Well, our Middle East editor Ian Black says it's far from certain whether the ceasefires will hold.
It's the big question. It's very fragile. Even after the Israelis announced the ceasefire, there were some rockets fired into Israel again by Hamas. And a few hours later, Hamas announced that it too was committing to a ceasefire, but it gave it just a week. The Israelis didn't give any time limit to it. And Hamas said a week, within which period all Israeli forces must be withdrawn from Gaza. So you have a dangerous situation of two people agreeing to a ceasefire without any contact between them or any common understanding of what it means. And my feeling is that it will hold in the big sense, in that there won't be immense breaches of it by either side, but I think there are quite likely to be some breaches of it. I think that we're entering a new situation where each side recognises that the fighting of the last 3 weeks has clearly done enormous damage in terms of Palestinian casualties. The Israelis probably feel that they've gone as far as they can politically, partly because of the Obama inauguration on Tuesday. But now there's an awful lot of very difficult agreements that have to be sewn up if the whole thing isn't going to fall apart again. And I think it's going to be a very difficult week and quite a hair-raising week of seeing if some of those arrangements can be put in place.
The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said yesterday that the Israeli operation had achieved its objectives. But as you say, just hours after the Israeli ceasefire began, Hamas rockets continued firing from Gaza into Israeli territory.
Well, I don't think the Israelis ever claimed that they were going to be able to stop Hamas firing rockets altogether. But I think what they will claim, they will argue, is that they've dealt such a blow to Hamas with this application of overwhelming force with the devastating consequences that we've seen, that they think that the Palestinians will think again very hard before trying to carry on attacking Israel with impunity, which in the Israeli perception is what they were doing before. Of course, from Hamas's point of view, their goal has been, I think, to goad Israel into action, to create a situation where Israel would come under pressure, as it certainly is doing, to lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, which is, that's the primary goal of the Palestinian leadership in Gaza. Now, whether that can be done or whether new arrangements can be made to secure the border between Egypt and Gaza, that's the route for smuggling weapons into the territory, that really remains to be seen. And that's one of the difficult things that is going to have to be tackled in the coming days.
We've got just a day to go now before Barack Obama takes over the presidency. Do you think we can expect action or some sort of announcement from the new president pretty soon after he is sworn in?
I think, taking everything that's happened in the last 3 weeks, through which period Obama has basically maintained his silence, it's hard to imagine that he won't make it a high priority on his first day or two in office to address this conflict. Everybody knows that it's got to involve the United States if there's ever going to be any kind of peaceful settlement of this. And I think that there will be a huge expectation that Obama will speak on the subject and at the very least signal a determination, which I think is absolutely required, that this American administration will be engaged intensively in attempts to resolve this conflict from day one.
Ian Black, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Gaza. Also on The Guardian's website today, Hadley Freeman on the ignominy of learning that her parents had joined Facebook. Guardian.co.uk/G2 to read about that. Charlie Brooker assesses the merits of having calorie information on menus. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Tokyo is bidding to host the 2016 Olympics, and part of authorities' efforts to clean up the Japanese capital involves a crackdown on the city's lucrative adult entertainment industry. Justin McCurry reports from what's being called Tokyo's Manhattan, Kabukicho.
It's early Saturday evening in downtown Tokyo, and one of the city's most colourful neighbourhoods is coming to life. Whether it's the whiff of grilled seafood, the ear-splitting promotion campaigns, or the riot of neon lights, a stroll around the narrow streets of Kabukicho is an assault on the senses no visitor to Japan should miss. But it's Kabukicho's other businesses, the host clubs, girly bars and massage parlours, that are attracting the attention of Tokyo authorities as they step up their bid to host the 2016 Olympics. For decades, Kabukicho's sleazier side was largely left alone, tolerated as a reasonably safe way to satisfy the carnal urges of inebriated salarymen. But now, police are enforcing a midnight curfew on sex clubs and host bars, and volunteers patrol the streets in an attempt to rid them of aggressive touts. While officials say they have no intention of destroying Kabukicho's appeal as Japan's carousing capital, the people who work here fear it will end up sanitized beyond recognition. At a place in the sun, a popular host club, Maki Tezuka is preparing for a busy night. In more relaxed times, Tezuka's club, where young men are paid to chat to female customers, pour their drinks, and yes, flirt a bit, would have stayed open until dawn. But the crackdown, which targets any establishment that offers personal services, however innocent, means his last client must now be out of the door by 1 a.m. And once the customers dry up, Tezuka believes Kabukicho will never be the same again.
There's no discrimination here. Everyone is accepted for who they are. It doesn't matter if you're Chinese, Korean, English, or a transvestite. No one cares about your past, even if you've made mistakes. This is a place where people come to start over again. And after that, who knows what they might make of themselves. That's the great thing about Kabukicho.
Justin McCurry reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Ian Chambers and Andy Duckworth. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.